Commission's Ethics and Rules to order, and we are going to be hearing this morning from the Government Standards and Practices Commission, and this will be our last informational briefing, at least the scheduled ones, and on Monday we're going to start hearing bills, so that's we're plowing right in. So let's, without further ado, call Ron Burson. And anybody else? Did you bring anybody else with you, Ron?
No, I didn't.
Okay, great.
Most of the staff.
Yeah.
Most of the staff here.
Practically the whole staff of the GSPC represented here.
Have a third of the staff anyway.
Well, welcome to the Elections Committee.
Thank you for having me.
So I think, Ron, what we wanted to hear, and then committee members can ask you whatever questions they have, is just basically an overview of what the mission of the GSPC is, maybe what recent developments have been going on there. I know you haven't been on board for too long, but...
Not too long, but I did provide the committee with this handout, and people have it. And I want to introduce myself. My name is Ron Burson. I'm the Executive Director for Government Standards and Practices. I want to thank the committee for having me in today. And I'm going to take a little different strategy than I took with the Senate yesterday, because I think there was the way I did it before was maybe a little more confusing. So maybe we could just follow along in this handout. And what I'd like to do is share with the committee what government standards attempts to accomplish with the staff that we have. The first handout here is kind of an overview of the different years. And I'll point at this handout. It looks something like this. It's a little confusing to new folks that are looking at it. But what this is a breakdown of the number of complaints that we receive in the office each year. And the significant numbers are down towards the bottom. You'll notice that in 2006, even through the November of only through November of 2006, we were up to 108 complaints received in the office, as opposed to 2005, the entire 2005, there were 73. Hmm. And, you know, the committee could ask me questions on why that is, and I really wouldn't have a great answer for that. They vary each year. But as the GSPC gets kind of more attention, I think more people realize that this service is available to them, and they start contacting the agency. Now, up above, when we talk about additional information or non-jurisdictional, and additional information is somebody has actually submitted a complaint to the GSPC, but it's very vague, or it just doesn't contain enough information. So we actually send a letter back to them, ask them to provide some specific information back to us so we can go forward with that complaint. Non-jurisdictional, we get an awful lot, as you can see here. In 2006, we've gotten 31, where people are complaining about things that are not part of our jurisdiction. The GSPC is, even though it's very broad as far as the number of public officials that we oversee, the actual scope is very narrow. It's simply Chapter 244, ORS 244, Chapter 171, and I should go back, I'm sorry, 244 is around ethics, 171 is around lobbying, and then specifically 192.660, which is executive sessions. And so a lot of times people will write in and they're upset with their local public official, but it's not in an area that the GSPC actually has jurisdiction over. So we advise them of that. And if we can point them in the right direction, we do that at that time. There's a little category here called budget reduction. As we'll go on a little further with the presentation, the laws the GSPC operates underneath require us to complete an investigation in a prescribed time. But that time does not begin until we actually begin the investigation. And so this agency was not only had very few people in the last buy-in, they also lost their executive director last year. And so they were operating on two individuals in the office. And so they had a little category there they called budget reduction, and they obtained the complaint. They sent a letter to the person. They told them that they thought there may be something here, but due to budget constraints, they wouldn't be able to get to it for a period of time. And then those have all since been brought in, and we have addressed all those. But that's what that category is for. down below underneath the 39 for 2006, it breaks down the number of complaints and what actually happened to these. And I talked about the categories. Under ethics, we received 39. 18 were dismissed. 13 went to preliminary review. 5 into an investigative phase. There was 9 violations, 4 penalties, and 12 are pending. And I'll go further into what preliminary review and investigation actually means. And I'll go through reading this whole thing, but you can actually kind of see the breakdown of the complaint process here. On page 2, we were asked, my understanding, last session we were asked by the legislative body to actually provide what jurisdictions are actually using the GSPC and using our resources. And so this is a breakdown, and you can see in 2006 that there were 26% of our complaints were from city jurisdictions and 6% from counties, 32 from the state, 8 from education, 21 from special districts, and 8% from others. Mm-hmm. We also broke down the several years back, going back to 2000, and put an average. And as you can see, on the total average, the majority of the complaints received by the GSPC is received by local jurisdictions, more specifically city jurisdictions out there. So.
And it looks like actually that average might be a little bit skewed by the numbers from 2006, because it looks like your numbers for state jurisdiction went up dramatically this last year.
And it did, and I believe that was more towards the end of the year. We had some specific cases that came to us.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Another, on the next page, a service that the GSPC provides to all jurisdictions out there are advisory opinions. And people that are in public office or public entities can request the GSPC to basically they give a specific example and ask us our opinion. Is that legal or is it not? Is this a violation or is this something that we can do? And we respond to those requests for opinions. Now, the first request would be a staff opinion, and that would be the actual staff, and we would give that person our opinion. Now, we run those opinions through the Attorney General's office to make sure that what we believe the statutes are saying is actually what the statutes are saying. So it's not just myself making that determination. If the person would like to request an advisory opinion from the commission, in other words, we would bring that opinion to the commission. The commission would look at that and actually vote on it. Then that actually becomes binding. And so if the commission agrees and says this is not a violation and you do that specifically as we've given the opinion, the commission will not come back later and say that was a violation of whatever statute that comes about. So you'll notice that behind there are several pages, and what these pages were put in here for was there was some concern in fire bienniums that the GSPC was taking too long for these opinions, that people were asking us for some information and we just weren't getting back to them soon enough. And I just want to point out that the number to the right is the number of days, but that does not mean that 8 hours a day were spent on this opinion. This is just the amount of time from the time that they requested it to the time that opinion was issued. And the first several of them, first of all, I should back up. On the left here, you'll see that they'll start off with an 06, and those are opinions from the year 06, and they go back through 1999, and you can kind of see that we number them that way so we know what time period they came in. We also list the jurisdictions. Yesterday, before the Senate Rules Committee, I was asked a question about some of this unknown jurisdictions, and what that is a person writing in asking us an opinion, let's just say, about school districts. Can they do this? And so they're not asking about specifically Portland School District. They're asking, can a school district do this? And so we, even though it is, the opinion is given back to a specific person, it's listed as unknown because it would work for all those school districts.
Ron, just to clarify, these are then formal opinions that you issue in writing as opposed to just questions you might get on the phone to clarify something, huh?
Chair Rosenbaum, yes it is. It's a formal written opinion. And the difference between a staff opinion and, as you see further back, the shorter list, the advisory opinions, is that an advisory opinion is actually brought before the commission. The commission agrees with that opinion, votes, and essentially codifies that that opinion by voting in favor of that. And like I say, that actually becomes binding. Now, I cannot find any examples in the past where the GSPC has given a staff opinion and come back and then ask the commission to go against their own staff opinion and have a violation against anybody. But in the statutes, an advisory opinion does become binding for us. And I just want to point out again on the time frames, I think it's very impressive the time frames that they actually do get back these people. And if the committee would like to see some examples of these opinions, they are listed on our website, and they are very complex. And some of the issues that are asked to us are very complex and require not only researching our own statutes, but researching statutes out there that may have to do with real estate transactions and many other things. So it's a very in-depth process. And so even though you may look at something and say it took 21 days to get back, it's actually very impressive, especially with the small amount of staff that they had.
Representative Berger, you had a question?
Not a question, just a comment for the committee that the work group spent a lot of time going through this system, and you'll see some efforts to sort of codify it and put it on the web in a more, because this really saves everybody time if you know, what's it worth a quick phone call?
Right.
What's its value versus an opinion that holds some, you know, sort of weight? And so we spent a lot of time, and I presume we're going to be hearing more about the Law Commission review of this whole system, because we were looking for ways to make the workload easier and have more surety, and so there's less time answering the same question over and over again, because it matters a lot.
And, Ron, who has the ability to request these opinions? I see there are some private companies listed here, so it's not just the entities that you regulate, huh?
Chair Rosenbaum, that is true. It is any Oregonian can ask for these opinions.
And then the cost is just borne out of your budget?
Yes, this is one of the duties that we perform for Oregonians.
Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Madam Chair. My question is that oftentimes these entities have their own rules. Now, your opinions are only about their application to the state law, not their own rules. At the same time, I mean, maybe they've imposed more restrictions on themselves than, say, the state government does. So when you're doing an opinion, are you only referring to the how it is affected by the state laws or their own rules?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin, mm-hmm. That is true. We simply, our opinions are based on whichever statute that we regulate. So an example with ethics is the opinion would strictly be on Chapter 244. So if some entity actually had stricter regulations, that would not become part of our opinion.
Okay.
The next page, we talk about training presentations, and unfortunately you'll see in 05 and 06 that there is no information available. The problem there was, as my understanding was, is the former director actually kept track of this training type presentations on a handwritten type of calendar, your little black book that you carry around, and I believe that traveled with that person away from this position. And so we have instituted much better tracking on keeping track of our presentations and strictly doing that. So there should be good numbers in the future. I apologize for that. But it gives you an idea of the number of requests that come into the office for the GSPC to come out and actually give a formal training. And in this year's governor's recommended budget, we've actually included a position that would be around training, and this would be part of their duties, not the entire duties, of course, but part of those duties.
Can I ask a question on that, Madam Chair?
Representative Hunt.
Thank you. That seems to be really the one of the core issues, I think, not just for GSPC, but for any state agency, is how proactive you all can be, we all can be, about getting that information out there. What have you identified? I mean, I see the slide from 1999, there being 88 presentations that year, down to 22 in 2006. Have you set a level that you think is the optimal level that perhaps with this new position you could be at, or where we should be in terms of those proactive presentations?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, actually, I provided this information just for historical and to explain to the committee some of the duties that we do. But frankly, I don't put a lot of stock in the face-to-face presentations. And the reason I say that, I go back and explain myself, is that. This agency, we can talk about the number of public officials that we regulate. Some people say, it's 200,000. I think the best number I can come up with is about 170,000. But even in our best year here, we are actually have an audience of 3,600. And, if we actually did a percentage on that, that would be a pretty poor percentage. And so we're actually trying to look at more innovative ways of getting our information out. And I think Representative Berger actually talked a little bit about it, is these advisory opinions. When we give an advisory opinion, if everybody knows that you simply click on our website and you can get that information instantly, then they're not calling the office. Now, back to the training, I would actually like to see where this agency on their website has some type of digital format type of training where if I'm a city council and I've got a new city council member coming in a rural part of the state, instead of requesting the GSPC to drive there and give a presentation for a few people, they simply can click on that website and download or a copy onto a DVD and have that person listen to a presentation. And we could have presentations on all kinds of different issues. And so, I hope to take, obviously the face-to-face is still going to be there and we're still going to look for this, but we're going to add just an enormous amount of information out there. And we do have to get out in front of these problems. One of the biggest issues that I hear from just starting with the agency is that we didn't know. We weren't sure. We took somebody else's advice, or we just weren't sure. And so that's unacceptable. And with this day and age, with electronics the way they are, there's no reason that we can't have that information out there instantaneous when anybody wants it. So, but you asked me the optimal number. I would like to see more of this, but that is going to happen. One of the natural transitions, I think, that is from going from a director to a new director is the new people always kind of bring in more enthusiasm, and so we're out there trying to, get ourselves on the agendas and get ourselves out in front of folks, if anything, just to meet everybody. So I appreciate your question. Thank you. Okay, moving right along here. There was some historical data that I put in here for our Attorney General costs. I don't want you to be fooled by the last biennium that they're very low. They're rising quickly. I think we're going to meet that goal. And unfortunately, the one thing I do want to point out with the Attorney General costs for the agency, they've really only increased by the number that the Department of Justice has raised their assessment. So the actual number of hours that were used in an attorney has really not risen. And sure, that has led to the GSPC trying to find innovative ways to end a lot of these cases at the lowest possible level. But that's also sometimes to the detriment of actually getting some type of definition on certain items. And an example that is that recently, when we're talking about events that public officials go to, the GSPC, through their complaint actions, has really never defined what an event is, because we haven't pushed that issue. We've always kind of settled the cases at the lowest possible level, but nobody's actually taken the time to actually have somebody, judicial type of fashion actually look at what is an actual event. I mean, it's easy to say if I'm invited to an event and I'm there on the agenda, I'm there to speak, and you have brought me in to do that, and you have paid my way to do that, then that would be an event. I'm on the agenda. And so would that be an item that you would have to declare on your statement of economic interest? Yes. But isn't an event if I'm one of 1,000 people there and I'm at a table, but I'm available for people to come and talk to me and get my opinion and have conversations? I don't know. So sometimes it's to a detriment of not actually spending the money up front and actually getting somebody's opinions has led to some confusion out there. I put a list in here of lobbyist registration. It's a little bit confusing for folks, but when you register as a lobbyist, you actually register for 2 years. So what you'd like to do here is if you took the 2006, in December 2006, you'll see there were 629 lobbyists registered in 640 entities. Well, if you compare that with 2004, that has gone up from 481 and 550. So it's gone up significantly. There's quite a bit more lobbyists and quite a bit more entities that are registering with the GSPC to perform their duties in the state of Oregon. So.
And run back to the legal expenses for a moment. Has there ever been a time when the GSPC had a staff attorney on its own staff, or has any consideration ever been given to whether that might be a good thing to have?
Chair Rosenbaum, to my knowledge, there has not been a staff attorney with the GSPC, but we have an attorney assigned to us specifically with the Department of Justice that has been with the agency for quite some time and is very knowledgeable on our laws and rules. And so we go to a specific person, and like I say, there's been quite a bit of longevity there. Okay, and the last thing on this handout is SEI filings, and I know we don't like acronyms, but that is Statement of Economic Interest. And there's some confusion on the number of public officials that need to file the Statement of Economic Interest. And right now there are 4,394, and that's just an updated from the last list you have here. But so out of that, whatever that number is, let's just say it's 170,000 public officials out there, 4,394 must file a statement of economic interest. Now, one of the items that the Law Commission had talked about back was when the GSPC was formed, it was formed through a ballot measure in 1974. And when that process happened, there were, I believe, 96 or 97 cities and 6 counties that the majority of the people in those entities did not vote in favor of this ballot measure. So it was below 50%, and they were excluded back in 1974. So one of the issues that came up was, is should we include them now? And I think that the Law Commission had actually agreed that those entities should be brought in. So we are expecting this number of people to come up. Now, another thing, and I'm not sure if the Law Commission actually looked at this, because, again, I came into the process late, but the people that are actually listed in the statute are to file Statement of Economic Interest. I don't know if the Law Commission actually looked at those folks, and the only reason I bring it up is I actually received a call from a director, or actually from a director's assistant, wanting to know they had actually gone to a multi-state conference. It was paid for by a private entity to come in and speak. It was an event for them to speak at, and they wanted to know if they needed to file that. And, you know, my first reaction was, yes, you need to declare that. But when he actually looked at the statute, that director was not part of the statute, but the commissioners that director works for is part of the statute. So we might even want to look at who's been listed on that. I asked the agency about some history of that, and they don't believe that those people have been looked at, the specific directors of state agencies and other people on there have been looked at for a while. So that may be something else we want to look at to add to it, just for a side note.
So could you repeat what you said about when this was passed by an initiative in 1974 that it didn't pass in certain counties and those are not currently covered? Is that right?
Chair Rosenbaum, that is true. They are covered. They just simply do not have to file the SEI.
And how many counties is that?
I believe it is 6 counties and 96 or 97 cities.
Wow.
So they were excluded from having to declare to their citizens their statement of economic interest.
And was that part of the language of the ballot measure, that if it didn't pass, then those entities wouldn't be required to comply?
Chair Rosenbaum,
it's a very strange interpretation. I'm sure there were a lot of other initiatives where local counties might like to get implemented too.
I can't testify to what the ballot measure said, but that is in the statute at this time.
Metric, I follow.
Yes, Representative Beckley.
Thank you. For those counties, are their officials still sent the form to fill out? They're not required to fill it out, but are they still sent it?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, no, they are not.
Okay. Wow.
You're kidding.
I don't think he's kidding.
It's amazing.
Representative Berger.
Madam Chair, this just points up another one of those mysteries in life that we talked about. We all fill one out because it arrives in our mail with a very forceful letter that says, fill this out or you're in deep doo-doo. And think of all the other people in the state who get it, and yet what's the authority there? No one's ever really sat down and asked. We get the letter, therefore we have to fill it out.
Right.
And I mean, in our case, it's pretty obvious, but think of these 4,500 people and the sort of government misunderstanding.
Well, and that raises another question, Ron, is how do you know who all you have to send these forms to? Who'd let you know that there are elected officials or public employees that are required to file? Is it up to the counties or the state? How do you get those names?
Chair Rosenbaum, yes. If the entities give us the individuals to send the statement of economic interest to, and if there are any changes, then they are to report that to the GSPC. So if a person leaves a position and they bring another person in for that position, then they give us that information. And those things that are sent out are addressed. And I apologize if the letter is actually that forceful. I haven't seen the letter. I apologize. But maybe there's a better way of wording that.
And you said that there is a bill coming in to change this exemption for those counties that originally didn't pass the measure then.
Chair Rosenbaum, that is my understanding. On December 20th, the Law Commission met, and they actually voted to move some legislative concepts forward. I have not seen those concepts come about yet, but my understanding is they will be introduced in Senate rules.
I see their staff attorney is in the room. I actually haven't seen that bill on the list of recommendations from the Law Commission. But Sam, did you want to come forward and clarify that? And please identify yourself for the record.
Sure. For the record, Sam Sears, staff attorney with the Oregon Law Commission. I believe we're talking about the statement of economic interest in certain cities and counties that were originally opted out of filing the SEI form. That is true. The Law Commission did look at that, and from my recollection, that ballot measure originally went out, and it included in, I think, in that language, it was more of an opt-out, or if the counties did not, they voted, and if they did not want to have those officials fill out an SEI form, they did not have to. And I remember seeing the list of counties and cities, mostly rural. Some of the cities, like Kaiser, that was not around at the time, are not in that list, but that is one of the things the Law Commission looked at. And I don't know exactly what the reason was for having that in the original ballot measure, but it's something the Law Commission looked at to include all of those officials that are in those cities and counties. We just didn't see a reason to have those officials not filing the SEI, so that is one of the recommendations in the bills.
And so there is a bill coming forward to require compliance for all.
Yes, yes, that is part, that is in the package.
Okay, great.
All right.
Yeah, Representative Roblin.
Thank you, Chair. I guess then, you know, when we were talking earlier about the most common complaint is they didn't know, a lot of officials. If only 4,000 are getting the forms to fill out about this, and there's 170,000 people out there who are under the jurisdiction of these rules, that's one of the key areas of why they might not know that they even have to think about it, because that form reminds every one of us, for sure, that we have an obligation to understand the rules. And when you're not getting that, and you're going along, and no one else in your local jurisdiction has mentioned it, it would be understanding that they might not understand the rules, I guess. That's one of the concerns. So I know that the commission is going to ask for another group, but it's, again, the same group. So we're still going to be 100-some thousand people who are under the jurisdiction of GSE are not really going to have any formal thing, piece of paper sent to them saying, remember, now as a public official, you are under these statutes. Is that correct? We don't send anything like that out, a notification, do we?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roblin, that is correct. But again, going back to Representative Hunt's question about the training, is an obligation as an agency to get out in front of this and explain to somebody when they do come into even state government. Unfortunately, we don't even train. You know, we haven't done a really great job of training our own state employees. When you come into work for state government, that you actually become a public official and you are underneath these guidelines that are spelled out in Chapter 244 of the Oregon Revised Statutes. And so you aren't able to, benefit from your position. You're not able to, you need to declare a conflict of interest. You can't, in other words, if you're in charge of purchasing for your agency, you can't give your brother-in-law the purchasing contract. I mean, there's all these things that come into play, and we do need to get out in front of this and explain to folks that this is an obligation that we do hold, will hold them to.
Representative Berger.
If I could make one more comment. In this process, I thought I kind of understood this book of laws or what it was all about. And then the former director invited members of the commission to come to a GSPC executive session, which is, you don't talk about it, except to say that it was just the biggest eye-opener of my life to sit there and listen to what the commission. You know, it's really, they have to have the wisdom of Solomon, because as we know, it's all personal and it could all be politicized, and it matters a lot. And to have people come in before this commission and listen and then say, boy, I'm glad I'm not up there and have to make those decisions. I would really, if possible, encourage you to take an opportunity to see how this commission has to make really, these are life-changing decisions for the people involved, and it's throughout the state. I mean, we take the high-profile hits, but these are just ordinary folks who are trying to do their best for government and do their jobs and their families. It was really interesting.
I'm just going to go ahead and go forward. Just one other area I did want to talk about briefly is the complaint process with the GSPC. There seemed to be some confusion on what's expected or what happens when somebody, a complaint does come in. And what happens is we can receive a signed complaint. In other words, a citizen can make a complaint against a public official and they sign that complaint. I, as the executive director, would look at that information and I would make a determination. I talked a little earlier, do we need additional information? Is this jurisdictional? Or do I think that we can actually go forward with it? If it is a complaint that I believe we can go forward with because there's enough information and I believe a violation has occurred, then I will begin a preliminary review. At that time, that preliminary review is a 90-day review that is confidential. So when the good Representative Berger had actually talked about an executive session, these are talked about in executive session because there hasn't been a determination made on any kind of fault or any kind of violation. And so it's important that these public officials, that this information does stay confidential during this time. And it also allows the agency to use that time to gain information from the respondent. And they can be assured that the information that are given to the agency is kept confidential. So during this time, we will look at that. We'll do a preliminary review. We will come back to the commission and give that information to the commission. We also give that information to the respondent. And the respondent has a chance to come before the commission in executive session and explain the information. And they have a copy of the report. And they all in that report, they will see the staff recommendation, either to move this forward or to go ahead and dismiss it. And so they can come in and they can dispute the facts that are in that report. They can talk to the commission. They can agree with the facts and ask for forgiveness for the commission. They can do whatever strategy they would like to do during that time. Again, during a confidential session. At that time, the commission will make a decision whether to move the case forward. If they move the case forward, it goes into an investigative phase. That is a 120-day phase, of which we are allowed 130-day extension, and we can also expand the scope during this stage. So if other information comes up and other violations come up, we can expand that scope during this stage. Now, I want to point out very, very strongly that we are in constant contact with the people that are being investigated at that time. So it's not a surprise to them that the scope actually gets expanded if that happens. Now, once that 120-day phase, then it actually is public. And so then the records, and that's all the records, including the preliminary review report, does become public at that time. And at the end of that phase, then the commission would vote to either find a violation or, again, dismiss it at that point. At that point, if we find a violation, then the person does have a chance to go to contested case. Currently, the law allows a person to have two choices in that contested case. They can either follow the Administrative Procedures Act and sit before a hearings officer from the Office of Administrative Hearings and explain their case. Or they can opt out of that process and they can go to Marion County Court. The one thing I want to point about the days that I gave, again, back to the 90 days for the preliminary review and the 120 days, and I talked about a 30-day extension, those are statutory numbers. And therefore, if the GSPC goes to 91 days, that case is dismissed. So it dismisses statutorily on the 90th day. So many times, just with the way the meetings are scheduled, there are many times where, well, all the time is never 90 days. It's always less than 90 days that we get in there. So the process sounds like it's quite long, but it isn't quite as long as it sounds like, because we need to be to the commission beforehand so that the statute does not dismiss the case. And the other thing about people say sometimes it's too long, but again, going back to Representative Berger's comments, it's important that we have all the information in there and that we're very careful with what we're doing, because again, these can be life-changing type of issues, and we all know that these issues can be brought forward to the public in several different ways, and so we want to make sure that that our facts are correct, so we don't get in too big a hurry here. So I just wanted to point that investigative process out. So it's very encumbered. It's a well thought out process. It takes quite a bit of time, and there's a lot of thought put into it. And again, going back to the commissioners, they do have a very difficult time making these decisions at times. So I'm trying to think. I believe that's the end of my presentation.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. No, thank you very much. It's been very informative. I've been wondering, since it does seem so important to have access to the type of information you presented to us today on the website, is there a timeline and a plan to develop your website to the point where you have a frequently asked questions section and local officials and others and members of the public can check in and get this kind of information?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, as far as a timeline, I haven't got a specific timeline, but that is the plan. And what we're looking for right now is unfortunately, the GSPC right now is still staffed with three people, and I probably don't add as much value as I should over there. I mean, the technical people are still very busy just trying to keep up with, again, I go back to this complaint process, there's these statutory limits that we have to have things done by, but this in the governor's recommended budget, there are additional positions that are brought in. One is a clerical type position to try to free up the person right now that's doing that so that they can do more work in some of these areas. And again, I alluded to the training position, and that person, I will be looking for somebody that has a web experience so that currently right now the GPC relies on the Department of Administrative Services to update their website, and it's just a cumbersome process. I want to take that away and let us do that, and so that would become part of this person's duties, is not only keep that website up to date, but continue to expand that website so it contacts more and more people. So,
Representative Baskerville.
Yes, in the governor's budget, there is additional personnel. One of the big problems, I think, Patrick Hearn was up against is he didn't have enough people. Do you feel it's adequate what's in the governor's budget, or do we need to increase your investigative force? Because that was Patrick's real concern, was the investigative force.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Esquivel. Make sure I get that correct. It is a concern of mine on the investigative side. And I have been speaking with folks on that. Again, I kind of inherited this budget coming in. And when I looked at it, I actually am looking for funding to try to get one additional investigator, too, on top of what the governor's recommended budget has. And I have informed the governor's office of that request. And also with legislative fiscal office knows about that request.
Follower?
Yes, it's not really a follow-up question, but I would hope that we would recommend that you go forth and do that because, in my opinion, we lost a great guy in Patrick Hearn. He'd been here for a long time, knew the territory, knew how the system worked, and it's unfortunate we lost him. But one of the big reasons, I think Patrick and I discussed this last session, he couldn't get any more investigative people that he desperately needed, so I would hope that we'd provide that for you.
Can I make one comment?
Sure.
I'd just like to make one comment on that, too, and this is true. The current investigator that works for the commission right now, it's the only time I've ever seen it in a non-24-hour agency, but my people are topped out on vacation time and topped out on comp time. I've never seen that happen before, like I say, without the state hospital or something that has 24-hour service and they get a lot of comp time. That it's amazing the work that they have done with a little bit of people, and yes, they do need help on the investigative side, too.
Representative Thatcher.
Yes, thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you for your presentation. I've learned a lot. I was just curious, though. There's a little section you talked a little bit about lobby and people who have filed to become lobbyists. I'm just curious, do public officials ever register as lobbyists?
Representative Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, I think you're my representative. Hello. Yes, you have to register as a lobbyist if you have lobbied for more than 24 hours or spent $100 or more in a quarter. So public officials do need to register as lobbyists. An example is myself. I register as a lobbyist because I have more than 24 hours of face-to-face contact in a quarter. And so what we're encouraging people to do as public officials is keep track of that time, and when you're getting close to that time, go and register, but don't register beforehand, because once you do register, then that will kick in the required reports to be filed. And an example, in legislative years, it's three reports. In non-legislative years, it's two reports that you need to file on the amount of money that you've spent out there. So we require people to keep track of that. But, yes, public officials do need to register as lobbyists if they break that threshold. And, by the way, just talking about the reporting requirements in the Law Commission's recommendations, they have recommended to have quarterly filings in each year. And they've also recommended to add an additional filing, which the agency currently does not have, and that is an additional filing on gifts, and those would be quarterly filings also on gifts received.
Follow-up question.
Follow-up?
You talked a little bit about gifts. Have we defined what gifts are yet? One person's gift could be another person's pile of information. Who knows?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, that's the magic bullet there, isn't it? There's been a lot of talk about gifts and the difference between gifts and honorary. Gifts are actually defined in statute, but again, we go back to, is this a gift? And I think what the Law Commission really tried to concentrate on is trying. I know that they struggle with this, and I wasn't part of the group, and I came in later, so I want to speak for them. But my understanding is most of the concentration in this area has been trying to set a dollar limit, that once you break that threshold, then you're going to report that. And currently, right now, we're looking at $50. So somebody still could get I think they actually use the word token type of, receive some type of token appreciation, and it really doesn't become a gift to be reported until it breaks that threshold of $50. There's also some requirements that they've asked from us to try to audit these reports. And we would be happy to do that. Currently, we can't audit those reports because what a lobbyist needs to report as far as what they have given for a gift and what a public official has to report of what they received for a gift are two different things. And so there's nothing to audit against. But in the Law Commission's recommendations, they are shoring that up, whereas everybody's reporting the same thing, so you actually could come back and do some type of random audits in there to look for compliance.
Thank you. Representative Hunt?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I just wanted to follow up on Representative Esquivel's question. I mean, with your current staffing levels now, you talked about the process where it comes in, you have a staff part of the process, and then a commission part of the process, and potentially an investigative part of the process. That's got to be a factor today. In addition to what just the ethical guidelines are in statute, it's got to be a factor for you in terms of how you decide what you're going to pursue and not, and how in-depth you're going to pursue it and how careful you're going to pursue it. I realize you're new to the position, but based on what you've seen, talk about how that intersects now, the understaffing levels impact your ability to do the process at the staff level and the investigative level that should be done.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, I would love to testify here today to say that the staff actually looks at something and says, well, that may not be as important, so we're not going to put as much effort into it. But what I've seen that the staff has done when I wasn't there and what the staff has done since I've been there is that is not the case. We actually look at a case when it comes in. If we believe that there is a violation and there's enough information, then they will get a full review of that information at whatever level that is. And I have not made any decisions in the agency saying that this is maybe a small issue that we shouldn't look at or we should put it off. I did point out that during the time when they were by themselves there, that there were some cases that they asked the public, and frankly, the letter wasn't maybe as nasty as the SEI letter, but they were basically asking the public for some patience. You know, we believe there may be a problem here, and we will look into it. And we also contacted the complainant to make sure that was all right with them. But that was really the only thing that I've seen them do to try to manage that workload. And again, going back to the workload, I mean, the workload is not dependent on the agency. The workload is, just brought to us. And so I really haven't seen that to be the case. I mean, I'd like to testify to that fact that we're passing up cases because we don't have enough staff. But the staff there has actually done an amazing job to get the work out The problem with it, if you start making those decisions is that whatever Oregonian gave that complaint in, that may be the only time they've actually contacted state government, maybe in their life. And if we actually don't give that kind of the full treatment, I think we're doing a disservice to them.
Okay. Mm-hmm. Well, then,
go ahead.
I realize this was prior to your time. 2 years ago, Senator Nelson and I filed an ethics complaint against a ballot measure campaign related to workers' comp. And it was clear based on the response that we got back that the staffing levels were a factor in why that complaint was not pursued. And so that's actually great that your staff are working during all their vacation and comp time to make sure those are done. I mean, is your sense that the impact of the low staffing levels is therefore most felt today in terms of the lack of training, the lack of proactive information sharing that might prevent some ethics problems down the road. Is that what is really taking the hit today by the lack of staffing levels?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Hunt, yes, I think that is. There's the one area that we have been deficient on. I also alluded to the website. The website is behind. We're not taking full advantage of when the state of Oregon went to brand Oregon websites. It essentially gave every agency the same size website out there, and we could use it, unlimited uses out there. And this agency has not been able to take advantage of that. We have not got out in front of some of these problems. We have not trained folks. We have not informed people of their obligations. And it has led to some instances coming up. But the investigative side of it, I haven't seen, like I said, I haven't seen the agency use that side of it to try to shore up some of these shortcomings of staff. But I've definitely seen it on the training side. And
well, I can certainly attest, and I find this remarkable, given the staffing that you've got, that a live person generally answers the phone when you call your agency. And usually, at least in my experience, you get an answer if you're just asking an informational question right then and there. So I think it's pretty impressive that you've been able to manage to do that with a relatively skeleton staff.
They're an impressive staff.
I wanted to follow up on a question that Representative Roblin asked earlier, and that's the disparity between the number of people that you have jurisdiction over and the number of filings that you get on these statements of economic interest. So maybe you could talk a little bit about what the jurisdiction actually is, and is there a difference between the officials and employees that you regulate and those that are required to file that form?
Chair Rosenbaum, yes, there is a difference between the folks. It looks like to me when the statute was originally written for the agency, they were looking at high-level, high-profile type of individuals to declare to the public their statement of economic interest. And they actually listed state officers in the statute. And just to give some examples of this is like the Adjutant General, the Director of Agriculture, the Director of the Department of Revenue, some of these kind of high-profile Director of the Department of Administrative Services. They also looked at a lot of entities that were out there. Members of boards, so the State Board of Education, Fish and Wildlife Commission, some of these very public type of, I'm just guessing what they were looking at the time is they were probably looking at individuals that the public may have interest in and looking at where their economic interest is at. And so I can't really testify to why these individuals were put down. I simply testified earlier that it may be a time that we want to look at the list of people that are here and doesn't need to be updated. I mean, I know that there's been a lot of agencies that have been added to the state of Oregon, and I know there's a lot of different folks. But an example is that they put my position in there as the Director of Government Standards and Practice, which, of course, makes sense. But, I mean, people might want to know, where my interest lies is that I'm supposed to be the director of the ethics in the state of Oregon. So what I feel is they were looking for, the high-profile individuals that the public would be interested in.
And what's the statute that you're referring to?
Oh, I'm sorry. The statute that I'm referring to, Chair Rosenbaum, is ORS 244.050. And just to testify to the statement of economic interest are due on the same day the taxes are due, 415. So,
and that's the statute that spells out who's required to file the SCI form?
That is correct.
And then is there a difference? I mean, are there other people, employees, state employees or local government, whatever, that are not required to file that form, but yet they are subject to regulation by the Government Standards and Practices Commission?
Chair Rosenbaum, yes. Everybody that's actually a public official, and public official is also spelled out in the statutes of Chapter 244. If I can't find it here real quickly for you. So it's underneath Chapter 244.020, subsection 13, talks about a public official means any person who, on the date... Oh, never mind, that's not the right one. Sorry, that's on the... A little different note. Well, I can get that information for you, what a public official is. But to answer your question is that everybody that is a public official is underneath these or required to follow these statutes and could be the subject of an investigation by the commission. And that could be anywhere from, a custodian type of person at a school district to the state court administrator. I mean, it does the gamut. I mean, if you're working for a public agency, you are a public official, and you are not allowed to use your position to benefit.
So basically anybody that works for any governmental entity is subject to regulation by you?
That is correct.
And how about, I've heard volunteer firefighters are subject to these statutes, and I mean, would that extend to everybody who volunteers for a governmental entity, too?
Chair Rosenbaum, that is correct. So any of our volunteer board members or commission members here at the state, an example is the commissioners for the GSPC are subject to this. You use volunteer firefighters, and yes, they have they are in the public trust. They are working for a public entity at the time. And many of them are unpaid positions. That's what makes it difficult to tell you how many people actually fall underneath these statutes. I was trying to count the number of people. I mean, I started out with the using PERS, or public employee retirement system, as a place to start, and because most of the school districts. And PERS has about 156,000 people in PERS right now that are active members of PERS. But the Portland Police Bureau, Portland Fire District, they're not part of PERS at this point. They just became part of PERS, but they're not part of this group. The volunteers that are not paid are not part of PERS. So it's difficult to come up with an exact number of people. But a lot of people use the examples of volunteer firefighter, and it's true that we do regulate those folks. I know there's some concern in hearing I had yesterday about that, but again, they're held the same standard as any other public employee. An example is a volunteer firefighter goes into your house to help you in some way, and your Rolex watch is laying on the ground, and they pick it up. I mean, they should be subject to having an ethics violation. I mean, you can't benefit from that. Once you actually put yourself kind of in that realm of working for a public agency, then you become a public official.
Representative Roebling.
And is it once they have become that volunteer fireman in all aspects of their life, they're under these jurisdictions, or is it only when they are performing the duties of that volunteerism?
Representative Rosenbaum, or I'm sorry, Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Roebling. I don't know the answer to that. I'd have to actually ask our legal counsel on when you're kind of off the clock. I'm not sure. It would have to be you'd need to benefit from your position. So if you benefited because you found somebody that wanted to buy your vehicle, that would not be the case, just because you were a volunteer fireman. But if you actually benefited because you only benefited because you were a volunteer firefighter, I'm just trying to think of examples. Maybe they're letting you buy these heavy-duty rubber boots that firefighters use for half price because you are a volunteer firefighter. Then that would not be allowed.
Okay.
Follow up.
Or if another person was hiring and they will only hire volunteer firefighters?
Chair,
I
would have to confer with my legal counsel.
Yeah, I understand.
I'm not sure on that.
Mr. Pruder, we have to set up for sure.
Madam Chair, consider you're a teacher and you use your interoffice email to advertise if you have a car for sale. You know? Hello?
Sure. Yeah, sure.
What happened in Medford?
Yeah, I mean, it's...
But I guess this raises a question for me as we're looking at jurisdiction is whether there are maybe some glitches right now that are making people subject to these statutes that don't really need to be, because some of these matters are really more personnel matters than ethics matters. I'm not sure that we really need every person that volunteers for a school, who I guess theoretically they're also subject to these statutes. It seems like it could be, although I bet you that people don't have a clue that they're subject to ethics violations when they're just volunteering at their kids' schools, but it could be a disincentive for people to step forward and do some of the things we want them to do. So do you have an opinion about whether there might be some need to clean up these statutes and make fewer Oregonians subject to them?
Chair Rosenbaum, I guess my comment on that is that I would hope that it would not discourage people to be volunteers at their schools or in their communities for any kind of government-type agency that's asking for volunteers because they could be the subject of an ethics complaint, because I would hope that they never thought of that as being part of the volunteerism. They have no desire to benefit from their position. And so we haven't found that to be the case. I mean, I don't know if there's any examples out there of people walking away from volunteerism because they do become subject to our laws and rules. So
on the other hand, is there any way they would know that they're subject to these laws when they volunteer?
Chair Rosenbaum, again, I would have a hard time testifying that they would, because again, but I hope to remedy that. I think that we need to get the word out there to folks that we require them, once you actually go to work for a public body, to hold yourself to this higher standard. And I actually think that people require that. They require that of their teachers, but they also require that of the volunteers that are watching the children on the playgrounds. I think that they require those people to have that higher standard. And your volunteer fire department and reserve officers that are in police departments and all of these positions to be at that level.
Representative Esquivel.
Madam Chair, to answer your question, actually, the answer is no, because I was on the city council for over a year, and then all of a sudden I get this thing in the mail. I had no idea what was going on there. And I had, no one told me about it. So the answer is no.
Representative Roblin.
And I would say that there are other groups and schools and stuff that are getting better at it and do explain that to people. The Aspire program is very clear on a whole bunch of the issues we're ground around what their responsibilities are once they take on that responsibility. And I do believe that it at times does have a sombering effect, in part because we have never been extremely clear on what each of these things mean. That's why we have you to ask. And so what it does is it makes people leery, because I'm covered by them, but I don't know exactly what they are. So I don't know if I've exactly done it or not. I'm going to do the best that I can, and I think I'm being ethical, but every once in a while they'll hear something and it'll sound like, well, how would I have known that? So I think there is an issue with respect to making it more difficult to get people to volunteer if you raise the issue that you recognize all these things are. In schools, you instantly become a new volunteer, a mandatory reporter. That's an interesting issue for a lot of people. That makes it hard for some. But again, I think it's absolutely essential that they understand that, and absolutely essential that we should hold them to that standard, because they are going to be working with people, and they gain some credibility and trust of others by the fact that they are a member of that group. And so there are some things, but it would certainly be easier if it was a lot clearer, so you can hand them a sheet and say, here's the 10 things we're talking about you have to do, which has not been very easy to do.
Representative Buckley.
Thank you, Madam Chair. I have to agree with my colleague's comments there, and again emphasize the need for the website and the information to be available. Switching subjects just slightly, if that's all right. Ron, can you remind me when the ballot initiative passed, what was the original name of the commission? Did we change the name to Standards and Practices?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Buckley, yes, it was changed to Government Standards and Practices, and I believe it was called originally the Oregon Commission on Ethics.
Thank you.
And as you know, in the papers, it's always called the Ethics Commission.
Right.
about changing here. That, but it is, I know it is not part of the recommendations at this time.
Can I ask a question, Representative Berger? Was there any discussion with the Law Commission on that about possibly changing the name back?
There was. I was in on that discussion, and I guess there is so many other things around this book of laws that we were grappling with that seemed a lot more important than name change issues. That it was like, let's not march up that hill. We got plenty of other hills to climb here. At least that was sort of my feeling. But yes, there was discussion about, you know, what does GSPC mean to the ordinary public? But it's also, you know, apropos of the discussion we just had, you're a volunteer in the schools, and suddenly you get a letter or a phone call that says the Ethics Commission is investigating you, it stops your heart. Mm-hmm. But if the Government Standards and Practices Commission is investigating you, you think, well, maybe I have a hope. You know? So, I don't know the psychology of that, but when you look at the universe of things, it was sort of, let's not go there because there's a whole bunch of other work to do, and maybe if this body wants to go there, feel free. By the time you've gotten through all of this, believe me.
Representative Thatcher.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Expanding on the theme that we've been kind of discussing the last few minutes about volunteers and what they know, what they don't know. Do you have any record or tracking or gut feel even as to how much problem there is with volunteers? Is this really an issue that maybe it could be, I don't know, lightened up a little bit on volunteers if it's not really a problem? It seems like it would be more of the people in positions of power that you'd really want to have tight rein on. You would want to make sure that they're not going to be abusing their position, but volunteers coming under this and not knowing about it, and then it possibly squelching volunteerism. And I'm just wondering if volunteers have historically been a problem.
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Thatcher, I don't know the number of complaints that have been against volunteers. I do know that a lot of the advisory opinions that the agency has done has kind of stemmed from asking what volunteers could and could not do. And so my feeling, when you ask me what my gut feeling is my gut feeling is that the leaders of these organizations that use volunteers are actually getting out in front of any problems that they might see happening with volunteers and asking us opinions before they get in trouble, just because of good leadership. Mm-hmm. And so we don't have a lot of complaints on volunteers, but it does happen. Representative Esquivel had said you were a city council member. We have had city council members that have, got themselves in trouble by they're volunteers because they're not paid. At least this person was an unpaid that I'm thinking of, was an unpaid city council member, and they kind of volunteered to do a job for a certain amount of money for the city, and so they got themselves into trouble. But I think the leaders of those groups actually try to, especially like say with the school districts, things like that, try to keep that from happening. But I just want to point out with volunteers, they have the same ability to benefit from their position as a person that's in a paid position. So they have that same opportunity. So if we don't regulate them, we actually do leave an opening for violations out there. And so,
Representative Ripland, no, Representative Esquivel.
I'm curious. It would be interesting to see with the complaint structure that we have and the amount of complaints we have pertaining to the volunteer people, I wonder how many of those councils and or planning commissions and or whatever they volunteer for do not have an attorney present during their meetings, because I think that circumvents a lot of things. But unfortunately, the smaller communities are unable to afford that luxury. Do you have any background on that? Do you know?
Chair Rosenbaum, Representative Esquivel, I do not. So.
Can I comment on that?
Sure.
One of the things that it became clear to me about was a lot of communities depend on council to interpret these laws for them, and these that doesn't necessarily work. You're not off the hook, Representative, if your city attorney tells you that you're not in violation. It is your responsibility, and that's why this website and this direct information and this training is so critical. Just because the attorney gave you advice doesn't make it so. I mean, it might, and that's one of the discussions we talked about, mitigating and having. One of the discussions we had was putting in some language that the body, the commission, could come up with some mitigating circumstances, one of which might be, you know, you went, you asked your attorney, there's a record of that, and he gave you bad advice, and you went ahead. But you're not off the hook because your attorney says it on these laws, and that's an issue.
Representative Thatcher.
I suppose along that same vein, I guess you wouldn't be off the hook necessarily if the chief clerk gave you permission to do something versus, or the gift committee, whatever it's called.
Guidelines.
I mean, just a guidelines committee, yes. And it seems like we still... We're it's buck stops here, you know. Well, hopefully. Not the buck, I'm sorry. find another word for that.
So actually, to the point that Representative Esquivel raises, now that I'm reading the statutes, it looks to me like the statute requires the city recorder or county clerk to inform all newly elected members of the city council of their obligation to file and being subject to these statutes. So sounds like you would have had a bone to pick if you'd known it at the time. I'm not sure.
So is that, how far does this go back? Will it go back past 10 years?
Is his county one of the exempt counties?
Yeah, we don't know that.
I religiously receive that every year.
Okay.
I'd just like to make one comment about the concern about the confusion on the GSPC's laws, and especially around Chapter 244, and even when you get into 171, around lobbying. One of the biggest benefits that I can see from the Law Commission's work is they have done a lot of work on trying to clear up some of this confusion and make it a more straightforward type of information out to people. And so one of my biggest hopes is during this process is that this does become much easier for that city council member in rural Oregon to know what their obligations are, and that we can be very specific in training them. I mean, right now I believe that I could go to a rural area and give them an in-depth many hours sitting in a desk training, and the next day they would probably still have a question for me. And so, you know, but these are the laws that we have right now, and that's what we're operating with. But through this process, and, you know, we really appreciate, you know, this committee's attention to the ethics laws and all the work that the Law Commission did, because one of the biggest benefits that's going to come out of this is it's going to clear up a lot of this kind of unknown type of issues that are out there.
Did you want to tell us anything about the commission itself, who's on it, and what its composition is?
Sure. Chair Rosema. Well, now I've got to know all the people's names. No, I don't know if I can do that.
Or if you don't have it with
But the commission itself is actually made up of seven members, and it's kind of a unique commission in its makeup, in that the House Democrats and the House Republicans each nominate an individual to the governor's office, and the Senate Democrats and Senate Republicans. And then the governor himself at this time has three nominees on the commission. So the seven members, there is a three governor members that he has nominated. There are a representative for the Senate Democrats, the Senate Republicans, the House Democrats, and the House Republicans. And so we try to meet about every 6 weeks, and we meet here in Salem each time. person's on the commission for 4 years. Now, a lot of times people have to leave the commission, and you can take over somebody's remaining term, and then you can be renewed for one additional term. So you could serve, I guess, the maximum you could ever get up to is what is that, 4 years, 364 days. But normally it's a four-year term, and sometimes people have a couple extra years in there because they've taken over somebody else's prior term. And they're only able to serve one term, one full term, I should say.
Okay. Are there any other questions for Ron? Okay, well, thank you very much, Ron, for appearing this morning. I'm sure we will be seeing more of you. perhaps not in your regulatory capacity, but as we have bills that pertain to your statutes and your charge. So
I really appreciate the committee's time. Thank you.
Great. Is there anybody else in the audience who wants to testify? Doesn't look like it. Okay, and we are adjourned.